God mode. The darkness was relieved only by the light orange glow of the computer screens. It was just past 1 in the morning. To fully appreciate what happened next, you have to remember that it had been at least 4 days since anyone had slept properly. Now, 6 of the 12 people on board were in the control room. Robert and Jim, their faces lit a pale orange, poked woozily at the computer screens, while the first mate, Jamie, hovered behind them and waited to hear the news. The screens offered no end of information. The sea beneath us was 5,732 meters deep. The wind behind us blew at 16 knots. The boat we were on drifted at a little more than a knot in the direction of Antarctica. The wine cellar was cool to perfection. The door to the captain's cabin was closed. The captain's lights were out. On and on the computer went, explaining everything but what we wanted to know. Why had the engine stopped? The engine was our salvation. The engine would propel us out of the path of cackling Filipino monkeys. The engine was what would take us home, instead of to Antarctica. Robert vanished into the bowels of the boat. 4 minutes later, the engine restarted and everyone breathed easier. Robert reappeared with the look of a man trying to disguise, even to himself, how pleased he was with his work. 30 seconds later, he had some help. The engine quit again. Again Robert vanished. Again the engine restarted. Again everyone breathed easier. And again Robert reappeared, but this time without a trace of self-satisfaction. The engine rewarded his humility. This time it did not quit. Louis now stumbled up the stairs from his cabin. Like all good photographers, Louis clearly had a talent for turning up where he wasn't wanted and remaining inconspicuous. Soon he was snapping away.
"Now you know," drawled Robert, just loud enough for Clark to hear, but not so loud that he clearly intended Clark to hear. "If you want to get your picture in the newspaper, all you have to do is to go to a screen, open up about 5 windows, and look like you know what you're doing."
Clark said nothing. Robert fixed things. Robert was useful. There was nothing wrong with Robert. Ergo, Robert was permitted his careful bit of insolence in this tense moment. Clark and Robert then stood together at the computer screens. Clark, of course, wanted to know what Robert had done. Robert explained to Clark that the problem was in something called the sea chest. The sea chest took in salt water from the ocean to cool the engine. The salt water did not actually circulate through the engine, of course. It merely drew away heat from the outside surface of the engine. If the sea chest contained air rather than water, the engine lost some of its ability to cool itself. The computer understood that it was dangerous for the engine to overheat. When the engine overheated, the computer shut the engine down.
"When I went down the first time, I saw air in the sea chest," Robert said. "I must not have got it all the first time I blew it out."
On that lovely mahogany bridge at 1 in the morning, there were 3 responses to our condition. The 5 non-technical people, me, Louis, Jamie, Peter, Cecilia, were pleased as punch. The sea chest, whatever the hell that was, had been fixed. The engine worked. We would not drift into Antarctica. The mechanical man, Robert, was satisfied but hardly pleased. Any time the engine failed, his world became slightly less certain. The 3rd response came from Clark. Clark always insisted on his own response to any technical problem, and it gave him a kind of control over the opinion surrounding the problem. He was distinctly concerned. After listening to Robert's explanation, he said,
"That doesn't make sense."
Robert asked him why not.
"The seas are too calm," said Clark. "I can see how the sea chest might take in air when the boat was really being tossed around, but it shouldn't take in air in these conditions."
At that point, the engine was running fine, and so this sounded like the idle carping of an intellectual. Clark pressed his point anyway.
"If the engine was overheating," he said, "we should have had an alarm before it shut down."
He motioned to the computer screen.
"The alarms that went off were all in response to the engine shutting down. They came after."
It wasn't that Robert failed to see the reason in Clark's thinking. He saw it clearly enough. Robert had worked for a lot of rich yacht owners. Clark was the first who presumed accurately to know a great deal about his machine. Robert was forever saying things like,
"The difference between talking to Jim and talking to Alan is the difference between talking to someone who understands what you are trying to tell him instantly, and someone who you know will never understand."
But Robert was equipped with a slightly different disposition than Clark's. When the machines were working, he was not inclined to suspect that something was wrong. And the engine worked. Robert said as much. Clark appeared to agree.
If the engine was running, Robert must have fixed it. Wearily, Robert returned to bed. Clark kept fiddling with the computer. 15 minutes later, the engine quit again. This time, as the ocean hurled us crazily, Jamie and Peter and Cecilia spoke nervously among themselves, though when they saw me coming, they shut up. When the crew begins to hide the situation from the passengers is when the passengers should begin to worry.
"This is crazy," Clark said, more to himself than to the 5 people who watched him with incomprehension. "I can't figure it out."
He pointed to what he was unable to figure out. Attached to the engine were dozens of sensors. The sensors measured pretty much everything that can be measured inside an engine. The computer ordered and monitored this data, but one piece of data, the pressure on the engine, made no sense. The number on the pressure gauge should always be positive. There was no such thing as negative pressure. The number should also be fairly small. Typically, it read between 1 and 2. Now the computer screen read -3888-3354.6669. It was a crazy number. The computer clearly had a screw loose. Clark said,
"Steve."
He turned around as if he expected to find Steve over his shoulder.
"Steve is where?" he asked.
"Steve's asleep," said Jamie.
It was now well past 2 in the morning. Steve was more than asleep, I said. Steve was in a coma.
"Wake him up," said Clark.
Steve was awakened. He struggled out of bed and up onto the bridge. He did not look well. The truth was that Steve's brain, unlike Clark's, had a limited appetite for technical malfunction. Steve long ago had banned computers from his home back in Silicon Valley to prevent the blasted machines from following him everywhere he went. Here on the high seas, he could not escape them. Here, home was a computer. In that falsely bright tone peculiar to people hoping to persuade others that they are fully conscious when they are not, Steve said,
"So, what's up?"
"Something is fucking up these computers," said Clark.
"That's new," said Steve. Steve and Clark now stared at the screens together. Clark pressed buttons with more energy than before, like a man who needed to get his money out of the ATM in a hurry. Apparently, a lot of the data was strange. According to the computer, for instance, the wind direction was exactly the opposite of what it was a few minutes earlier.
"The wind has really come around," said Clark.
He turned to Jamie.
"Has the wind changed?"
Jamie said that the wind had not changed. Sailors know these things.
"But this screen shows the wind coming out of the north," said Clark. "It was coming out of the south."
"This computer is definitely a bit funky," said Steve. "The wind direction is wrong on it."
"What the hell is going on?" Clark said.
It wasn't really a question. He wasn't exactly angry at Steve, more at the situation in which Steve, unfortunately, happened to be central.
"The computers have some strange problems," said Steve.
The only 2 people on board equipped even to discuss the computer for more than a minute or two stared uncomprehendingly at the funky screens. This was not obviously dramatic. 100 years from now, I thought, if they dredged us up perfectly preserved from the bottom of the ocean, the salvage team would conclude we had gone down without a struggle, staring blithely into a row of computer screens. On the other hand, 100 years from now, salvage crews might understand that staring at the computer screen on Jim Clark's boat was the fiercest form of struggle. With computer people, the appearance of inaction masks the drama of their thoughts. They were maybe the first tyrants to attempt to conquer the world logically. The screen was the fodder for their endless series of if-then statements. If the computer triggered alarms before the engine overheated, then the engine must not have overheated. If the engine did not overheat, then the trouble might lie outside the engine. If the problem was outside the engine, then it could be inside the computer. Since all of the important problems on the boat, with the exception of who had sex with whom and how well we ate, were rooted through the computer, this thought was not terribly reassuring. At length, Clark decided he could not get what he wanted out of the computers on the bridge.
"Let's go downstairs," he said.
We did. Once they were seated in front of the silicon graphics workstation built into the wall of his cabin, Clark's conversation with Steve vanished into a black hole of arcana.
"This negative number is very strange," said Clark.
"The MSB is in units of 10, said Steve.
God knows what it meant, but that's what he said.
"But you see here, it keeps flipping back to a large negative number," said Clark, punching a button, "which causes me to be suspicious that it's not in our code."
None of this made any sense to anyone who had not programmed the computer. But the general drift was now at least clear to me. The problem might not be in the engine, but in the software that controlled the engine. Clark thought that the crude computers attached to the engine, known as PLCs for Programmable Logic Controllers, could be transmitting bad data to the fancy silicon graphics machines in the computer room. He thought that the computers had wrongly perceived something wrong with the engine, and so switched the engine off. A problem in the software implicated Steve, but only in a general way. The PLCs had been programmed by some Dutch guys back in the boatyard. Programming PLCs was meant to be trivial, which was why the job had been left to the Dutch guys in the first place. Steve and Jim were well on their way to a long, baffling conversation about the boat's software, but before they could get there, the engine started up. The boat stopped pitching madly. It cut with renewed purpose through the sea. The engine, it seemed, had a mind of its own. Then Robert appeared with a sneaky smile on his face. All by himself, without telling anyone, he'd woken up, clambered down to the engine room, blown out the sea chest, and started up the engine. Now, however, he conceded that he could not swear he had fixed the deeper problem, since he was not sure what the deeper problem was. But at least the boat was running again. Clark and Steve returned to the bridge. This time, Robert followed. Up top, in front of the four big computer screens, Clark complained about the state of his art.
"Steve, something is really fucking these computers up," he said.
Steve muttered something about there being a lot more work to do. Clark then hit the button that pulled up the map of the world with Hyperion on it. Its accuracy had actually slipped since the trials in the North Sea. The boat appeared on the map as a blue scaphoid. At that moment, according to the computer, we were cruising just north of Yemen. Clark just stared at the screen as his yacht crept across the Saudi Arabian desert.
"Fuck it," was all he said.
Even he was too tired to think about what it might mean. In any case, he was soon distracted by other problems. On each side of the bridge were the radar screens that let us know if we were about to be plowed under by Filipino monkeys. The radar screen on the left began to blink like a faulty light bulb. Every other piece of equipment, along with the data it generated, had been stuffed away in cabinets, where they played the bit part of sending data directly to the computers. Clark's software acted as a kind of operating system through which every other instrument must connect. He had played the same sort of trick on the manufacturers of sailboat equipment as Microsoft played with the entire software industry. The radar was the lone exception. The radar was the only instrument Clark had neglected to subsume. He just never quite got around to doing it. When he saw the blinking radar, Clark's shoulders sagged. The radar had been his responsibility.
"I guess I created that problem," he said.
It was now well past 3 in the morning. No one wanted to bother with yet another computer problem. The engine was running fine. Robert was obviously exhausted. Still, he could not hide how pleased he was by his response to a potential crisis.
"Had we been in the Straits of Gibraltar with an oil tanker coming towards us," he said, "we'd have been all right. I had that engine running in 5 minutes.
He headed off to rescue sleep from the 2 hours before our watch. Steve wandered out on the aft deck and gazed up at the world's tallest mast. He noticed how much it resembled an endless chain of crucifixes that reached up and finally vanished into the starry night sky.
"You could hang huge statues of Jesus from each spreader, and it would look like a Mexican pickup truck," he said.
With that, he stumbled over to one of the computer screens on deck, the one Alan sat in front of but ignored, and stuck a yellow post-it sticker on its surface. It read, "Alan, I fucked up the longitude program. We are not in the Arabian desert. Steve." Then he, too, went back to bed. Clark soon followed. It was nearly 4 in the morning. After 3 hours of struggle, Hyperion was once again pointed south. The two men who fully understood the computer and the one man who fully understood the engine had exhausted themselves. At no point did it occur to any of these technical people to wake Alan Pryor. Through it all, he had slept soundly. In a technological crisis, the captain was plainly of no use, and all crises on board Hyperion were now technological. Chapter 16. Chasing Ghosts. The morning after the engine failed, the seas were unusually calm. For the first time since we'd left the Canaries, the sun shone bright and hot. Normally, there weren't more than 2 people on the bridge. Everyone who wasn't on watch either ate or slept or tried to. That afternoon was an exception.
Simon and Jamie and Cecilia swabbed the decks. Steve hunted for the bug that might have disturbed the engine. Robert nosed around in the kitchen cupboards and then disappeared down into the bowels of the ship. It was as if each person on board had offered himself a fresh start. Someone spotted a school of porpoises gambolling in the bow wake. Even Clark, in a brief but failed stab at genuine enthusiasm, came up top to see.
Hype 4 is talking to Hype 19, said Steve,
hunched over a computer and trying to find the bug that generated the numbers that made no sense. Each of the 21 computers on board had been assigned a number. According to Steve, they already had acquired their own personalities, a trait that did not bode well for the home of the future. Now two of the more troublesome were speaking to each other.
What?
Said Alan, disinterestedly, two seats away. He wasn't listening. He was reading intently from another computer screen.
There is something funky going on here, said Steve.
Alan continued staring into his own screen. Finally, after Steve had ascertained he was being ignored and gone back to the mystery at hand, Alan looked up. He said with the satisfaction of a man at the end of a long day's work,
"At home, just bought Excite."
Long pause.
"That's all right."
"Really?"
said Simon, the computer deckhand who was passing through.
"What did the stock do?"
He was interested.
"That's all right,"
exclaimed Alan again, more to himself than to Simon or Steve. He hit a few buttons on the keyboard he had hooked up to the computer. He was recalculating the value of his portfolio of highly volatile technology stocks. This turned out to be why Alan occasionally could be found wrapped in front of a computer screen. Twice a day, once at noon and again at 7 in the evening, he logged onto the Internet through the satellite phone. The satellite phone on board Hyperion had the mysterious authority of the conch in Lord of the Flies. It cost either $12 or $20 a minute, depending on which crew member quoted you the price. Its time was precious, except, of course, when Clark used it. Even in mid-Atlantic, Clark spent hours on end on the phone talking to journalists about Healthian, to friends who wanted him to invest in their new Internet startup, to anyone he thought might divert his mind from the tedium of the ocean crossing. For everyone else but Alan, the satellite phone was off-limits. The captain's control over it gave him his one real source of power, the power to determine what news came on board and when it came. When Alan logged on, he pulled down three clumps of digital data precious to the crew: email, the weather forecasts for the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, and the news from Wall Street. All in all, this took him about 4 minutes. In those 4 minutes, Alan sat wrapped before one of the five flat panel display screens on the bridge. It was the only time you ever saw him volunteer his attention to a computer screen, and the event clearly meant something to him. His shoulders tensed, then he swiveled in his high captain's chair and punched several buttons. One button sent the emails to their various recipients. Another sent the closing prices of stocks in his portfolio to a separate screen. A third sent financial analysis and the weather forecasts to the printer. He then turned fully around in his chair, opened the mahogany drawer with the printer inside of it, and grabbed the financial analysis. The weather forecasts presumably could wait. That day, at home, the company that sought to deliver the Internet into American homes through the pipes owned by cable television companies had announced it would be acquiring Excite, the Internet portal company. Excite's stock price had jumped 42 points. At Home's had leapt 6 points. Clark had helped to create At Home and talk Tom Jermalak, his old friend from Silicon Graphics, into running the company. By shrewdly following Clark's interest, Alan had purchased shares in At Home. By shrewdly following Alan's movements, Simon had done the same. Clark had sold his shares and made $40 million. Not Alan and Simon. They had held on. That was their strategy. Broadly, there are two types of stock market investors. The first might be called value investors. Probably the most famous set of rules for value investing were those laid down in the 1950s by Graham and Dodd. Graham and Dodd investors subject companies to careful analysis. They derive their sense of the fair value of a company's stock price from its profits. A company with no profits holds no appeal for a Graham and Dodd investor. As a result, no committed Graham and Dodd investor ever bought an Internet stock. Graham and Dodd investors are people who place a very high value on having the last laugh. In exchange for the privilege, they have missed out on a lot of laughs in between. Hyperion was no place for any Graham and Dodd investor. Graham and Dodd's classic text sat unread on the galley shelf, a tribute to some aborted attempt at serious financial analysis. The investors on board during our crossing fell into the second broad category, kamikaze investors. Kamikaze investors treat the market as more of a guessing game. They follow hunches, charts, rumors, and tips in an endless pursuit of the hot stock. Their view of the stock market is essentially mystical, or at any rate impervious to analysis. To the kamikaze investor, no price is too high to pay for a stock because it can always go higher. They rely heavily on the giddiness of others. Allen was a species of kamikaze investor. Until he met Clark 2 years earlier and Clark gave him options in Netscape, Allen had never invested in the stock market. But Netscape got him interested, more than interested. Soon he had bought shares in Cisco, At Home, Intel, Lucent. The list was as long as his arm, and most of what was on it had soared on a wing and a prayer. But Allen proved to have a wonderful touch. Everything he bought went up all the time. The exception had been the few months in the late summer and early fall of 1998 when the stock market collapsed, but from about the time the Microsoft trial opened, the market had soared. Deals were once again being done. IPOs were once again roaring. The combination of At Home with Excite, which valued the loss-making Excite at nearly $7 billion, was just another case in point. What Allen saw when he gazed into the computer screen were the rewards that came to a man who waited for his moment. They were the fruits that fell into the hands of the fellow who refused to budge from beneath the tree. For Captain Allen Pryor, the effect of the brief market collapse, which had doomed Healthion's IPO, was probably not a lot different from its effect on the millions of other Internet investors. It convinced him of the wisdom of his ways. Like most small Internet investors, Allen had clung to his portfolio of Netscapes and At-Homes and Excites and Ciscos right through the crash. That portfolio, accumulated over the past 18 months in a Dutch boatyard, was now worth 3 times what it had been just a couple of months ago. This proved to Allen that he should never sell the stocks he'd bought. No matter what the market did next, Allen maintained, he intended to hold on to his portfolio. Allen confined himself to one investment decision, whether to buy shares in a new company when it went public. Oddly enough, he never intended to act on information he dug up about his investments. This did nothing to allay his interest in the information. In the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, he pored over downloaded documents like a man perpetually on a hair trigger. Many of the crew of Hyperion, in the spirit of their captain, had also become kamikaze investors. All of them owned shares in Netscape and Healthion. A few of them owned shares in other Silicon Valley companies. Allen Pryor owned them all. The frustration of selling too early was as alien to them as it was to their captain. They, like millions of others like them, believed the future would be better than the past. This happy mood was what egged Clark on in his quest to invent that future. Today they saw for the umpteenth time the brilliance of the strategy. Cisco, another of their favorites, was up more than 3 points. AOL was up 2. Lucent was up again. It had quadrupled in the 18 months since Allen first discovered it. Indeed, every single stock into which Allen had plunged was up big.
"The problem with investing in the U.S., said Allen, still talking mainly to himself, "is the capital gains tax. "They get you even if you aren't a U.S. citizen, said Simon knowledgeably.
I asked Simon how he made his investment decisions.
"I just take Allen's advice, said Simon, causing Graham and Dodd to perform a ballet adieu in their graves. "He's been right most of the time.
"Most of the time, said Allen somewhat modestly.
He told Simon to buy At Home when At Home was at 25. Today the stock had reached 57.
"Except on eBay, said Simon.
"eBay,
exclaimed Allen. Should have done that one.
eBay had gone public a few months earlier. Since then it had gone from 10 to 215.
But imagine the capital gains tax if we had, said Simon.
It is unfair, agreed Allen.
But still.
He looked at his printout. His newly recalculated wealth appeared to diminish his sense of being done wrong by the United States government. The truth was, since Allen never sold, the U.S. capital gains tax was to him more a theoretical than a practical problem.
"I don't really see the point of selling," he said.
The remark caught Steve's attention. Steve was a day trader. Day trader was one of those phrases popularized by the Internet, which made it cheaper and easier and less embarrassing, since like masturbation it typically was a purely private act, for people to buy and sell the same stock in the same day. As a confirmed day trader, Steve enjoyed looking for patterns in stock prices and thought the market often offered these up to anyone willing to watch.
"Netscape used to go through a regular cycle," Steve explained without looking up from his screen. You'd buy it at 20 and sell it at 28. There was nothing to it, really.
Netscape used to be the dog of my portfolio, said Alan. Now...
He gazed down the long page listing his portfolio. He'd bought Netscape at 44. It had plunged to 17. But now...
It's all right, he said.
Not as all right as the portfolio, but then the portfolio was up 300%. For the next half hour or so, until Robert wandered up from the engine room, the computer programmer and the deckhand and the skipper of Hyperion dwelled on the miracle of Internet investing. Then Robert appeared, and Alan found something else to do.
I think they're all mad, said Robert, after Alan had left. Alan just sits there all day thinking about his money. But if you ask him what any of these companies do, he has no idea. He wants to be rich, but he's not logical about his money.
That night, the engine quit again. It happened at nearly the same time as before, around 2 in the morning. Once again, Jamie, Peter, and Cecilia were on watch. Once again, Clark, Steve, and Robert came out of their berths to cope with the problem. Once again, the captain was left to sleep. The only difference this time was the level of frustration on Robert's face. He'd spent the better part of the day searching for whatever had caused the engine to fail the night before. At some point, he decided that he must have fixed it.
Every engineer will tell you, he said, that it is much harder to find what's wrong with a machine when it seems to be working. It's called chasing ghosts. I spent all day chasing ghosts.
This time Robert did not tarry in the bridge with Clark, who once again in God mode sat punching buttons on the computer screen. Instead, he went immediately down 2 sets of stairs to the engine room. The engine room was the only place on board to which no thought had been given about the comfort of the people inside it. It was hot. It was loud enough that Robert needed ear mufflers, but it was as tidy as any place on the boat, maybe more so. Robert's tools hung neatly in their racks, and his dirty clothes were piled primly in a can outside.
A good engineer has to be orderly, Robert shouted over the roar of the machines. If I died tomorrow, someone else could come into my world and pick up where I left off, because there is a logical way of doing it, a structure.
He paused.
If you want to be a good engineer, you have to be willing to be replaceable. This whole I'm irreplaceable thing drives me bloody nuts.
Once inside the engine room, Robert's face was transformed. His movements, usually lethargic, quickened. In a few square feet he performed a kind of dance with his machines. Clearly he could have done it blindfolded. A few years ago, when Robert had sought to have himself certified to work on powerboats, he'd done pretty much just that. He'd gone for the test back home in England, and his interviewer had asked him detailed questions about the engine room of a supertanker. The test was designed for people who had worked on container ships. Robert, who had never seen the inside of a container ship, failed badly. He spent the next 2 weeks in a library. From books, he built a 3-dimensional model of a supertanker's engine room. He committed the entire complex space to memory and returned to the test center. The same interviewer fired questions at him, asking him to walk through the little steps of repairing various machines on board a supertanker, expecting him, of course, to fail. Robert recorded a perfect score. The man assumed Robert had spent the previous 2 weeks on board a ship. He said,
"It's like a different bloke has walked in here."
At the end of the test, he wanted to shake Robert's hand. Now Robert moved around a space he knew from hard experience. On board, he had 1,400 spare parts, $300,000 of spare parts, and he understood where each of them went. Again, he flushed out the sea chest and restarted the engine. The engine was busted in a way that permitted him to switch it back on easily enough. Once the engine started, he did not wait around to see if it would keep on chugging. Certain now that the problem was more fundamental than air in the sea chest, he went hunting for it. He pulled himself beneath the giant BWM engine and fiddled a bit. Then he popped up and removed a cap from the top of it and fiddled a bit more. As he fiddled, Steve wandered in. From the discomfort on his face, it was clear Steve hadn't spent much time here.
"It's bloody hot in here," he said.
Although Steve's title was engineer, he had about as much experience of low technology as I did. He was the new engineer.
"We don't have an air-conditioned office," said Robert from under the engine.
"No air-conditioned office with cappuccinos and dirty pictures on the web 24 hours a day," said Steve, looking around.
Here they were, a pair of British engineers employed by the same American billionaire, ostensibly working on the same project, and their idea of work could not be more different.
Steve watched Robert tinker with the machinery with the same impotent expression computer illiterates wore when they watched someone like Steve write software. It was the expression of a man who has nothing whatsoever to offer to the problem at hand. Finally, Robert climbed up and out from under the engine and said,
"I don't think it's the engine."
Which meant that the problem was the sensor, or the network linking it to the rest of the boat. A chain of information ran through Hyperion. To a great extent, the boat had been reduced to information. The information had its own logic. The sensors measured everything that Clark could think to measure, including the pressure on the engine. They passed these measurements up to the programmable logic controllers. The PLCs, in turn, passed the data down wires to the high-speed silicon graphics computers. The computers organized and presented the data to the captain and crew. Somewhere along that chain was a kink. The question was, where? It could be inside the sensor itself, or in the PLCs, or in the fancy silicon graphics computers. After prodding the sensor a bit, Robert said,
"I don't think it is the sensor."
Robert's mind was working its way upstream. If it wasn't the engine, and it wasn't the sensor, then the problem lay somewhere between the sensor and the computers. The closer Robert came to the computers, the less sure of himself he became.
"I've got to work out how the system is getting its information. How the PLCs send it to SCADA," said Robert.
SCADA was an acronym for the hopeful title they'd given to their software, Superior Control and Data Acquisition. SCADA was what Steve and Lance and Tim and Clark had spent so much of their time writing. It picked up the digitized information from all over the boat and manipulated it in any way it needed to be manipulated. Steve and Robert left the engine room and made for the neighboring computer room to find out what SCADA had to say. The 21 slender black machines were arranged lengthwise along a wall, which resembled a sales rack in a discount outlet for VCRs. Robert had little patience for what went on inside them.
"They just make my job more complicated."
He had spent a great deal of the last year trying to explain the engine room to Tim and Lance and Steve to avoid problems just like this one. Of the computer people, the only one who had impressed Robert as an engineer was Clark himself.
"Take Lance," Robert said when Steve popped upstairs.
I'd missed Lance on this trip and his attempt to infuse computer programming with the romantic spirit.
"Lance is an unusually intelligent man," said Robert. "Yet the guy can't remember where he left his shoes. And when he goes to Amsterdam for a visit, he gets ripped off. What you need to be a good engineer is a set of skills, in addition to a logical process. Some people have an aptitude for it, some people never will."
The programmers came at the boat from the top down. Robert came at it from the bottom up. Robert believed his approach led to a deeper understanding of the machine. While Steve was gone, he said,
"One of the problems here is that the computer program is designed to control things that the programmers themselves do not understand."
Robert's resistance to the computer was a resistance to abstraction. The computer engineer has a postmodern flavor to him, which is perhaps why it is so difficult for him to explain even to other computer engineers what he does for a living. The honest answer is that he gazes into a screen and thinks. He is a creator of concepts. Robert, by contrast, was a practical man. He wanted to see what he was fixing. At length, Steve returned. Together, he and Robert hunted for the lines of code that concerned the engine. Steve pulled up one page of obscure-looking numbers, and Robert snorted.
"That's the first time I've even seen that bloody page."
To anyone who has not seen it before, computer code is meaningless. Robert had taught himself to program a bit, but he was nevertheless disturbed by the way it removed real-world problems from the real world. As Steve looked on, Robert complained.
"The only way I can read the life functions of the engine is via the computer system," he said. "The only way I can know what stopped the engine is this page here."
He hit a few buttons and up popped a screen filled with numbers.
"The old way, I'd have gauges on everything that would let me interact directly with the engine. On this boat, you have to go to a computer screen and go looking for it."
He pauses.
"On this boat, if I want to turn on the light, I have to go to a computer screen."
"It's the modern world," said Steve.
"There are a million lines of code in there," said Robert,
motioning to the 21 computers,
"and nowhere in them will you find the word boat."
After an hour of digging around in the code, both Robert and Steve decided that the problem was beyond their grasp and probably would take a long time to repair. Given that they couldn't find the break in the chain of information running from the engine to the computers, the only thing to do was to remove the chain.
"My next move," said Robert, "is to bypass the sensor. I can always fool the engine into thinking the sensor is not there."
And that is what he did, though he dreaded doing it.
"It's the very worst thing an engineer can do," he explained, "to pull a plug and leave something unprotected."
He went into the engine and yanked out the sensors. By yanking out the sensor, he yanked out the link between the engine and Clark's computers, and thus prevented the computers from shutting the engine down arbitrarily. Unfortunately, it also prevented the computer from shutting down the engine when it needed to be shut down. Effectively, he removed the engine entirely from the computer's monitoring system. This small rebellion against the new technology, staged at 4 in the morning, earned Robert the right to return to bed, but he did so uneasily. With the sensor gone, the engine could overheat without anyone noticing. It could catch fire, even blow up, without warning. The boat was suddenly a lot more dangerous. For 2 full days, we motorsailed along without incident. The tedium exceeded even Clark's expectations. Every hour or so, I'd check the computer screen to see how far we'd gone. Every hour, we'd traveled a mere 11 miles more. The 7th night out, there was a new kind of trouble. Why the crises on Clark's boat could not occur at 1 in the afternoon rather than 1 in the morning, I do not know, but they never did. At 1 in the morning, an hour into his watch, Steve wandered out onto the aft deck, looked up at the sail, and saw what looked like a pillow coming off the side. The pillow was growing. Finally, the night sky was filled with a chaotic whiteness. The sail was collapsing onto the deck. Its billowy heaps collected at the base of the mast, a kite the size of a mansion struggling to take flight. The strange thing about the event was the silence that accompanied it. The main halyard had broken. The halyard was the rope that kept the sail hoisted. Clearly, it was a bad moment. The world's largest sail, containing more wind than any sail in history, was on the loose. 5,500 square feet of sail flapped violently in the wind, with only a rope at the bottom of the mast to hold it in place. Flap one way, and it would have sailed off the side of the boat. Flap the other way, and it would have knocked Steve off the side of the boat. And the computer had nothing to say about any of it. No alarm, no sound of any kind. Steve sounded the alarm, inadvertently. He hollered. Up from the bowels of the ship came running the entire crew, Clark and Louis. Barely awake, they threw their bodies recklessly on top of the sail in an attempt to take the wind out of it and to prevent it from flying overboard. It took the crew about 15 minutes of pouncing on air pockets to remove the last trace of wind from the sail. Once they'd subdued it, they found another rope, replaced the broken halyard, and hoisted the sail. As they worked, Clark looked on with a curiously detached expression. It was not, as you might think, the look of a man distressed that his boat is falling apart in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. With all hell breaking loose on the foredeck, Clark was the calmest thing on board. Indeed, he wore an expression I hadn't ever really seen on him, contentment. Clark often struggled mightily to fake a contentment he did not feel. When Fortune magazine turned up to take his picture for the cover, for instance, he leaned back with a big cigar in his mouth and offered them the picture they wanted, of a successful California entrepreneur. He really did feel some strong impulse to meet other people's initial expectations of him. He did this without ever actually feeling contented. He was living disproof of the idea that California is home to people with a gift for relaxing. California was, at best, the place for people who wish to appear relaxed. At any rate, now that his boat was falling apart, Clark actually appeared to be happy. A few months earlier, at the boatyard, he had explained to me what was so unusual about Hyperion.
"Everything on board is measured," he had said. "Everything."
Everything had to be measured or quantified for the computer to get its mind around it. Clearly, that statement was not true. The rope that held the sail up was not measured. It had broken without the slightest reaction from the computer. Seeing this, Clark said,
"You could probably figure out a way to put sensors on the rope so that you can tell when they frayed."
That thought, he might have something more to tinker with, gave Clark a sense of purpose. He was perhaps the first owner of a mega-yacht who enjoyed his boat better when it was broken. Once they'd tamed the sail, the crew, led by Jamie, threaded a new rope through the sail and hoisted it up the mast. Clark watched them work with a mixture of admiration towards Jamie and intrigue that there were parts of the boat that his computers did not yet control. Finally, as the sail rose again, he turned to me and asked, "Do you ever get scared?" The moment he asked his question, I realized that I didn't. Not really. I was the ideal recipient of his new technology. Technically inept, thoroughly lazy, I was quick to place my trust in people who professed to understand how the various machines on which my life depended worked. Of course, every now and then, say when an airplane went bump in a storm, my stomach clenched, and all assumptions momentarily were called into doubt. But those moments always passed. "No," I said. "I do," he said seriously. He must have noticed the new uncertainty on my face. "On some fundamental level, I'm astonished that any of it works." Then he laughed and returned to his cabin. That was the burden of the technical man. He knew the many ways technology could fail, and he realized that he alone was responsible for its success. The next evening, it was Jamie who first sensed something new was wrong. He heard a sound as he walked past the mast. The sound, whatever it was not something the computers picked up on. There was no obvious sign of anything wrong, but the mast did make a faint clicking sound that Jamie had never heard it make, and he made a point of knowing all the sounds on the boat. This one, so faint that it barely registered, was entirely new. Click, click, click. It bothered Jamie enough that he decided to climb the mast to see what might be causing it. This in itself seemed an act of madness. It crossed my mind that the computers had taken over so much of the business on the boat that the human beings strained their imaginations to remain relevant. The whole point of the computers was to reduce the sailing to a science, and to eliminate the dependency on human nerve and instinct, or, at any rate, limit it to the nerve and instinct of computer programmers. Jamie was reasserting the need for nerve and instinct. The seas were rougher than they had been in days. The boat pitched and rolled with sufficient violence that you had to concentrate to remain upright on deck. The top of the mast was 200 feet off the ocean, or about 17 stories. The slightest sway on the deck was experienced at the top of the mast as a violent rock. Even in calm seas, it was hurled back and forth like a particularly treacherous ride at an amusement park. Now, with each roll of the boat below, it swung hundreds of feet across the sky with an ugly, corkscrewing motion. Jamie was, in a sense, the most articulate expression of Alan Pryor's sailing skill. He'd been hired by the captain to be Hyperion's first mate. He had sailed with Alan in round-the-world races, and was generally acknowledged by the crew to have a special knack. Whatever it was that made a sailor, Jamie, like Alan, had it. He was one of those people who seems to have been born to his assigned role. Only he wasn't. Jamie had come to sailing by circumstance and not choice. He'd started his career farming the Australian outback. In the early 1980s, a drought drove him from the land and sent him seaward, looking for some other way to make a living. A friend told him about a job on a sailboat that was making an Atlantic crossing. Jamie knew so little about boats that when he was awakened at 3 a.m. for his first watch, his first instinct was to punch the guy who had woken him up. That all happened 15 years before, when Jamie was in his mid-20s. Now, on our 7th evening at sea, he'd heard a sound that no one else had heard. In response to that sound, he donned a thin harness shaped like a jockstrap and asked Cecilia, who was making her first long sailboat trip, to belay him up in it. The comely Cecilia spent a large part of each day with her nose buried in books with titles like Sailing Across the Atlantic Made Easy. Now Jamie's life was in her hands. Up, up, up the mast he went, using his feet to keep him attached until he was a pale white dot in the dusky sky. By the time he signaled Cecilia to stop cranking, he was near the top of the 17-story building, clinging to its sides with his legs. One slip, and he'd be finished. He would have been hurled out into space like a shot from a sling, and then back into the mast. He'd have been crushed, and crushed again. At first, Jamie had thought the sound in the mast might be the satellite dish, But he rose past the satellite dish and the second spreader, and the noise only grew louder. It grew louder, in fact, all the way to the top. Only when he arrived at the top of the mast did Jamie find its origin. The rope that had been strung up in place of the main halyard, that is, the rope that held up the massive sail, had ripped the sail. A fresh tear nearly a yard long ran down from the top. That is, what Jamie had detected when he walked by the mast was the very slight difference in the sound made by a 5,500-square-foot sail that is fully intact and a 5,500-square-foot sail that has a slight tear in it, 200 feet off the ground. As his body hurtled through the night sky, Jamie explained all this into a walkie-talkie. The entire sail was like a giant stocking on the verge of a run, he said. A strong gust of wind would rip it in two. One half would probably blow clear off the side. The other would flap crazily from its moorings at the base of the mast. The force of this event, on a sail of this size, might easily cause the mast to snap. The tear in the sail put an end to our sailing trip. The computers would learn no more about sailing on this trip. The only solution was to reel the sail back into the boom and put ourselves at the mercy of the quixotic engine. After an hour of flying through the dark at the top of the world's tallest mast, Jamie shimmied back to the deck. The rest of the crew sensed they had just witnessed an extraordinary piece of seamanship, though no one said much about it. But the next morning I did hear one person say, "I've been on boats where the mast is broken, but nothing like this. This is a whole nother beast." Thank God he went up there. This being Jim Clark's trip, it could not follow its expected course and arrive at its intended destination. When we set sail from the Canaries, we were headed to St. Bart's. 5 days into the 10-day crossing, Clark decided that St. Martin's made for a better landing. On the 9th day, he changed his mind again and told Allen to take the boat to Antigua. Antigua was closer. Antigua was also new. New was good. Clark was far happier doing something that he had just decided to do than something he had decided long ago. No decision was worth sticking to unless it had replaced several other decisions. We groped our way towards Antigua. A couple of 100 miles offshore, a spotted hawk flew overhead. It was a poignant moment. It often is when the first bird appears in the sky. The first bird, like a man ahead of his time, is a tragic figure. Typically, the first bird has flown too far from shore and is flapping its way to its death. The good news that land is near is quickly followed by the realization that land is not near enough for him. The crew gathers on deck and hopes that the bird will roost in the mast and sail back to shore. It almost never happens. The bird flapped on towards oblivion. A few hours later, Clark's jet plunged down out of the clouds and buzzed the boat. Everyone, Clark included, clambered up top and cheered. Chapter 17. The Turning Point. The Gulf Stream rose and banked over the untroubled sea and the bright white sand. As it leveled off, Cliff's voice came over the intercom. Cliff was one of the two pilots employed by Clark to fly his jet.
"Okay, all you billionaires back there," Cliff said. "They opened at 174.5 and 74.
There was no need to specify who or what they were. Obviously, they were the share prices for AOL and Netscape, which 6 weeks earlier AOL had agreed to purchase. You could hear the smile on Cliff's face. Cliff was a member of Clarkworld and therefore an owner of stock options in both Netscape and Healthion. Clark reached a bit too casually behind his seat and found a pocket calculator. Cliff's news was the cherry on top of the ice cream sundae of his relief that the crossing was finally over. AOL had agreed to swap 0.45 of its own shares for each outstanding share of Netscape. Clark owned 14.2 million shares of Netscape. He punched 0.45 times 14.2 million into the calculator. 6.3 million, the number of AOL shares he effectively owned, making his the biggest single chunk of AOL stock, larger even than that of Steve Case, who created and ran the company. He multiplied 6.3 million by 174.5. $1.1 billion. In our 10 days at sea, the value of his Netscape holdings had nearly tripled, from $25 a share to $74. It was late January 1999, and the stock market was rising even faster than it had fallen in the fall of 1998. Healthion was soon to make its second bid to go public. And once Healthion went public, Clark would be even richer. More to the point, he'd be free to move again. That was the unofficial sequence. Start it, sell it to the public, then announce the new thing. The stock market collapse had forced him to put off the public side of his quest for the new thing, though of course he had continued feverishly with his private search. Now the two were about to converge.
"This is fantasy land," he said, putting his calculator away.
All the way back to the United States, he marveled at the miracle of the stock market. Before we landed, he said,
"When Healthion goes public, I'm going to get a lot of attention very quickly. I have to figure out what to do with it."
In mid-February, Healthion finally went public. There was no transition between the failed IPO 5 months earlier and this one. No one asked how a company that the stock market deemed unworthy was now suddenly desirable. It just happened. The company now employed nearly 600 people. 400 of them were housed in the main office in an industrial park just north of San Jose. By 5 in the morning, on the day of the public share offering, they were all at work. There was almost nothing good to say about Healthion's offices except that they were no worse than most offices in Silicon Valley. From the outside, a low white stucco warehouse plopped down in a sea of asphalt and dressed up with a corporate logo to pass for an office building. Inside, you could count on one hand the attempts to enrich the employee's state of mind, the cheap fountain across from the reception desk, the etiolated plants, the universal weightlifting machine tucked away in the corner of the otherwise vacant rec room, the cappuccino maker Clark had bought and installed the day he founded the company. Otherwise, it was a sea of gray, fuzzy cubes. Some of the cubes were slightly larger than other cubes. Some had a view of the parking lot. Other than that, the place was as drably uniform as a commune. No number of balloons in the lobby or streamers in the rec room would turn it into a space anyone would regret leaving behind. The companies were built to change. No one was encouraged to grow attached to his personal space. By 5:30, the employees had assembled in the big rec room in front of the television set. Pavan, Kittu, Stewart, the band of Indians, they were all crammed into this one room. It smelled faintly of curry. The only sounds came from the television, tuned into CNBC. The ticker tape ran across the bottom of the screen. The NASDAQ opened up 64 points, or better than 2%. Yahoo and At Home were both up almost 10 points. No one could say what Healthion had done, since trading in the stock was suspended before it began due to an imbalance of orders. Healthion had offered 5 million shares in itself, or about 8% of the company. The initial demand, mainly from the big institutions, was more than 5 million shares. How much more, no one could be sure. Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs had ginned up a lot of interest. The deal was hot, or appeared to be, which amounted to the same thing. Healthion's shares had been offered at $7 apiece, but that was just what people paid who were lucky enough to receive what they signed up for. The important question was, at what price would the first trade occur? How much would people pay for shares in Healthion who didn't get as many as they wanted? At what price would the investors who paid $7 willingly part with their shares? Healthion's CFO, Jay Westerman, stood beside the trader at Morgan Stanley in Midtown Manhattan who was making the book in Healthion shares. He'd tell Pavan the price. Pavan would announce it to the room. Once the employees were informed trading had been suspended, attention shifted back and forth between the television and Pavan. Pavan would get the news about the stock price before CNBC. CNBC would get Jim Clark. The cable reporter was scheduled to interview Clark, though it was unclear exactly where Clark was at that moment. Mike Long sat on the Morgan Stanley trading desk in New York City. Clark was nowhere to be found. For the next 30 minutes, Pavan stood stoically in the front of the room with the cell phone to his ear, while the employees around him tittered. Among them, they controlled about 15 million shares, out of the 69 million shares outstanding. Pavan alone owned 1 million. Kittu, who stood beside Pavan, had 350,000. Stewart, who stood a bit off to one side, owned perhaps 100,000, though Stewart was coy about this. Altogether, the employees owned only a bit more than Clark, who at the time of the offering controlled 11.5 million shares.
It was a tribute to their belief in Silicon Valley's class system that they felt they had been treated generously. There had been no roadshow this time around. Instead, Mike Long had sat down with a handful of large institutional investors that the Morgan Stanley bankers felt would lead public opinion about the company. Long had decided in his mind that he deserved some of the blame for the failure of the IPO the first time around.
"The story in the fall was too complex," he said.
He had learned that in a business climate that changed as rapidly as this one did, no one on the outside had time to study the details of the business. That was a polite way of saying that a lot of potential investors had no idea what Healthion actually did. Healthion, like a lot of internet companies, was an ever-shifting abstraction. When asked what advice he might give to other serious American executives who were talked into running one of these Silicon Valley businesses, he'd say,
"It's not about business plans. You can't plan chaos."
This time, Long made his presentation to investors even simpler than before. Gone was any mention of the software, which no one understood anyway. All that mattered was that Long could say truthfully that the software had been installed successfully in doctors' computers just a few days after the nasty article in the Wall Street Journal implied that the software might never see the light of day. Gone, too, was the chart of many bubbles. Just as the magic diamond had given way to the chart of many bubbles, the chart of many bubbles now gave way to the golden triangle. The golden triangle distilled the high concept behind Healthion to its essential components. Doctors, patients, and healthcare institutions on the points of the triangle. Leaving just enough room for one asshole in the middle. The notion of one asshole in the middle was easier to put across when you summarized the entire Byzantine healthcare bureaucracy, most of which you intended to gut, with the phrase healthcare institutions. The math that Long asked investors to do was also even simpler than before. Healthion now had 200,000 physicians under contract. Soon enough, they'd all be wired into Healthion's system. Each time a physician hit a button on his computer to order a lab test or a prescription or a patient's medical record, Healthion would be paid between 9 and 35 cents. Long told investors that the company had handled 5 million transactions in 1998 and expected to handle 500 million in 1999, 1.5 billion in 2000, and so on for some time, until presumably every single healthcare transaction in America ran through its computers. You do the math. On top of that, Long said, Healthion could be the leading healthcare internet portal. People would come to the Healthion website for information. Once there, they could be sold all sorts of things. Healthion's story had improved in the retelling. The story may not have been quite as important as the willingness of the stock market to hear it, but the story still mattered a lot. No one could honestly claim to know what Healthion was worth. The company, in its brief history, had made nothing but losses. It would run through another several $100 million before it ever earned a dime. It could offer only a rough estimate of its revenues for the next few years, which no knowledgeable person or even intelligent ignoramus could take seriously. Healthion was worth whatever investors felt like paying for it, and that depended largely on public opinion. Healthion was running for president. The IPO was election day. The polls were moving in the right direction. Just a year earlier, the venture capitalists who had backed it thought its stock was worth zero. Just 6 months ago, the investment bankers who were taking it to market said they might be able to unload the stock at a price that implied a total value of a bit more than $500 million. Now there was talk in the rec room that the company might be worth $1 billion. And why not? The stock market was once again cooking up miracles. It was now possible that the big internet investors, Fidelity, Vanguard, Bowman Capital, Nicholas Applegate, Amerindo, would be intoxicated by Mike Long's story. If so, their excitement might well percolate all the way down to small investors like Captain Alan Pryor, poised in front of the one computer screen on Hyperion he felt happy about, ready to buy something new. The employees waited nearly 2 hours. At 9:15, Pavan shushed the room. A big smile flitted across his face, which he quickly swallowed in the interest of preserving his air of authority.
"They have demand for 40 million shares!"
he shouted. A cheer went up. They waited another 15 minutes. At 9:30, Pavan quieted the room again.
His expression suddenly became more serious, beyond serious, pained. He looked like a man with a stomach ache. The excitement of what he was about to say was nearly too much for him.
21 and a half,
he shouted. The 400 people in the room went wild. The ragtag collection of engineers and engineers' helpers suddenly were worth $300 million. Pavin waved his hand for silence. The room went quiet.
24,
Pavin shouted. More cheers. Again, Pavin raised his hand. Again, silence.
28,
Pavin shouted. More cheers. Now Pavin's hand was raised high and straight like a Roman orator's. The room went completely silent. It was filled with people whose fortunes were rocketing. At the rate they were going, they'd all be billionaires by nightfall. Rather gravely, Pavin announced,
1 million shares just traded at 33 and a quarter.
This time, a new sound greeted the news. Not cheering, laughing. Healthian's employees were turning and clapping each other in the back and laughing. 33 and a quarter. At that price, they ceased to be the justly rewarded victors of the race that went to the Swift. They became the lucky holders of a winning lottery ticket. One of the Indian engineers threw up his hands and jogged back to his cubicle and wrote a program that installed the Wall Street ticker tape on the top of his computer screen. 33 and a quarter. At 33, the company was worth $2.2 billion. Pavan Nigam was worth $33 million. Kittu Kalari was worth $10 million. Stewart was worth $3.5 million. Jim Clark was worth another $375 million. When you added in his stake in AOL, he was now worth $1.5 billion. All attention now shifted to the television set. One cheer went up when Healthian's stock price raced across the bottom. Another when the talking head announced that Healthian's was one of the most successful IPOs of all time. They were, collectively, a success. What the 400 people in the room wanted to see now was Jim Clark. A long time ago, Clark had told several of them personally what was going to happen.
At the end of the first trading day, Healthian will be worth $2 billion plus, he'd said. And I don't see any reason why it shouldn't go to $5 billion fairly quickly. It depends on what kind of publicity we get.
To the engineers, this was a mythical Clark moment. And I knew it to be a true myth because he had said that very thing to me a year and a half earlier. How often did a man say to you, "Come with me, I'll make you rich," and then tell you exactly how rich he was going to make you, and then do it? It was a bit like watching Babe Ruth stride to the plate and point to the fence with his bat. It went without saying that Clark was making it up as he went along. No one could know, even the day before, what financial public opinion would make of Healthian if and when it finally went public. But crack engineers like Pavan and Kittu and Stewart had believed him, and their faith trickled down. Not a single engineer had quit the company after the failed IPO. Each of them could have worked for any Silicon Valley startup they wanted to work for. The decision of where to work was, at that moment,